Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will be finding common ground and taking it to the next level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. This show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. It's my hope that you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. My guests will have differing spiritual belief systems, and some will have no spiritual beliefs. You may or you may not agree with things that are said. What I'd ask you to do is keep an open mind. This way, you can see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now, today's guest is an author of 50-plus novels. His name is Andrew Gray. And I'm going to read a little biography of his, and then I will introduce him. Andrew is an author who grew up in Western Michigan with a father who loved to tell stories and a mother who loved to read them. Since then, he has lived throughout the country and traveled throughout the world. He has a master's degree from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and works in information systems for a large corporation. Andrew's hobbies include collecting antiques, gardening, and leaving his dirty dishes anywhere but in the sink, particularly when writing. He considers himself blessed with an accepting family, fantastic friends, and the world's most supportive and loving partner. Andrew currently lives in beautiful, historic Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And with that said, I'd like to introduce him. This is Andrew. Andrew, how are you today?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for agreeing to appear on the show. I'm excited to have you here, and I'm looking forward to the next hour. I'm sure it won't be long enough, given all the material we have to cover, but we'll do the best we can, and if there's need to do more, we'll have another show maybe in the summertime. So anyhow, I'd like to just explore your growing up experience a little bit. Andrew identifies himself as an openly gay man, and I'd like to ask you, if you were in touch with your sexuality at the time that you were a child, what was it like for you?
I wish I was in touch with it when I was a child. For me, growing up was a painful experience. I was born in the 60s. I grew up in the 70s and early 80s. And when I was 17, my family moved from Muskegon, Michigan, which is a reasonably large town, to just outside Ludington, Michigan, which is very small. So basically what happened was I was just starting to figure out who I was, and then my whole world changed. All new friends, all new school, and a very closed world. So I just went back into myself. Basically, I did not really accept who I was until almost my late 20s.
Wow.
Yeah,
I was very closeted, very quiet.
I worked. I just threw myself into school or threw myself into work, but I didn't deal with who I was.
Hmm. Well, I can relate to that small town experience and having a difficult time as a child. I knew that I was gay. I didn't want to be gay. I wanted to be normal, quote-unquote, like everyone else. And so I had real self-esteem problems. I didn't know who to talk to, and I don't know if that was your experience. I came out
exactly
earlier than you, but it was a trial. It really was. So what sort of journey was involved in your coming out experience?
Well, for me, my saving grace was a couple who lived in, of all places, Reno, Nevada. I spent, in my mid-20s, I spent 2 years living in Los Angeles and one in San Francisco. Yes, I was in San Francisco, and I was deeply closeted. Figure that one out. But I had friends that I visited. They were an older couple. They were retired, and their names were Barb and Dottie. And Barb and Dottie lived in Reno, and they were a lot of fun, so I went over to visit. And basically, they were the first people in the world I came out to, and they were the ones that helped me figure out who I was.
And how old were you at the time?
I was about 27 at the time.
I see. Okay.
But it was a safe environment. It was an environment I knew I would be accepted, that I knew I was safe. And so I was finally able to figure out who I was. Yeah, try telling your
wonderful.
Parents you're gay over the phone long distance from California.
And that's how you did it?
That's how I had to do it. I bucked it up and told them one at a time, but I told them.
And how did that go?
I should have told them years earlier.
Uh-huh.
You know how it is. Fear.
Well, when did you have... I'm sorry for talking over you. I just wondered when you had the first inkling that you were gay.
Oh, I must have been 13.
Ah,
12, 13. You know, when most people sort of get the idea that they're different, and then, you know, you hit the seventh grade and everybody's talking about sex and stuff, and you're just starting to see that sort of stuff on television at that time. You know, you were getting some first gay characters on TV or gay movies that had gay characters. And so you sort of figured out, well, maybe that's me.
Mm.
But you wanted to be normal. You're 13 years old.
Right.
You want to be like all your friends, and you want to be like all the people at school.
You're a little bit...
like today. I mean, I have
right,
a friend that's a teacher.
Right. Things have changed.
And in her last class, she had a 14-year-old that came out of the closet.
Oh, my.
So in my town here in Carlisle, there's a gay-straight alliance at the high school, and they have kids as young as 13 years old.
How big is Carlisle?
Carlisle's about 18,000 people.
Wow, that's remarkable.
It's just west of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. We're a very, very old community. The town was originally laid out by William Penn and his wife all those years ago. So it's a very old place. I live in central Pennsylvania, and central Pennsylvania tends to be very conservative. But in and around Carlisle itself is much more liberal. And the school district is very supportive.
That's wonderful. You know, you were talking about being exposed to some movies with gay characters when you were a teen. You're probably 10 years younger than me, I would guess, because I was coming of age in the late 60s, and there was no such thing as a film with a gay character. So I'm a little bit envious, but the 70s weren't that much different. You know, the environment had not really turned the corner.
No, it had not. It had not. And living in a small town, it was like going back 10 years.
Right.
My brother is younger. I have a brother that's about 18 months younger than I am. And believe it or not, he was the first kid in our high school to wear Calvin Klein jeans. And he was picked on because he was wearing girls' jeans because, of course, they had never heard of Calvin Klein jeans for boys.
Oh, boy. Boy, that is a small town.
That's the town. And so coming out wasn't a possibility. Even thinking about it wasn't even a possibility. You just buried it deep and went up.
I hear you. Well, tell me, what motivated you to write gay fiction?
Well, I started writing, about 7 years ago. We had a 70th birthday party for my father, and we had it in the backyard around the pool, and everybody told me how much I looked like my father. Well, yeah, I did. I looked like a 7-year-old guy, so... So I decided to go to the gym. I decided to get in shape. And so I was on the treadmill. I needed something to read. So I started reading gay romance. I found them on Amazon, bought some, and sort of liked them. And they were good. They were sort of sexy because nothing makes the makes treadmill time go faster than reading sex. So, so I started reading, and after a while, I thought that I would try writing one, and I did.
Oh, cool. Well, I can't imagine reading sex. Go ahead.
I said I wrote the first one, and I sold it. And then I wrote my second book right away, and I sold that one to Dream Spinner Press, my current publisher, and I just love them. The publisher, her name is Elizabeth, is just incredible, and we have a great relationship, and she's been my publisher since 2008.
Well, you're really blessed to have a publisher. I just obtained one myself. I'm also an author. I'd self-published my first couple of books, but how wonderful that you were published right off the bat.
I just got
What was your first book?
My first book, which is no longer in print, it was entitled Master of the Rebels.
I like that title.
If you go to the Andrew Gray Books website, and you can pick up my email address, and if anyone sends me an email, I will send them a copy of the first book for free. I have an electronic form, and I will send it to anybody.
That's great. Tell us what your website address is.
www.andrewgraybooks.com.
Now, are all of your books romances, Andrew?
Yeah, they're all gay romance. They're all in the trade MM romances.
Okay.
Well,
tell me, what inspires your work?
It's hard to say. Everything. I've been inspired by articles on that I've read online on CNN. I've been inspired by stories from NPR. I've been inspired by works of art, paintings, sculptures. I've been inspired by sporting events, concerts. I went to a ballet rehearsal for the Nutcracker here in town, and I have the next story I'm going to write after the one I'm working on will have a ballet dancer as a character. I never know where they're going to come from. It just comes from everywhere, which is really cool because that makes the stories diverse. I've written stories set on farms. I have written stories set in Syria, in Haiti, Kansas.
What kind of research do you need to do?
Well, I've been to the Netherlands and I've been to Kansas. I try to do and place my works in places I've been. I have been to Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
So I have seen the destruction and the devastation after the earthquake, and so that's what I wrote. I have also been, as I said, to the Netherlands. I've been to Australia where I have set stories. I have been to Alaska. I have not been to Syria, which is where I set a story, so that took a great deal of research. Internet research. I got very lucky with this story. A friend of ours who's a lawyer, one of her law professors, who loves to read romance, happens to have been a lawyer for the United Nations and worked in refugee area for the United Nations. So he was an incredible resource on Syria and refugees and war, that sort of thing.
I see. Well, you know, I can imagine it would be easy to set a gay romance in the Netherlands, which is a very gay-friendly country. How did you happen to set a story in Haiti or in Syria where the attitudes might not be quite as friendly?
Well, in Haiti, it was inspired by a story on NPR about how little reconstruction and about how a lot of money has gone into Haiti, but how hundreds of thousands of people are still living in tent camps 3 years after the earthquake. So what I did was I set my romance in one of the tent camps. My main character was a doctor, sort of a Doctors Without Borders type. And I opened the story with him hearing a scream, and, you know, he goes to investigate because he's a doctor and it's the kind of person he is, and he basically sees a kid being attacked by other kids because he's gay. So he rescues him, and the story continues from there. So I actually weave in the attitudes. Now, I won't tell you how it ends, but it does have a happy ending.
Well, that's great. We like happy endings, and it sounds like by weaving in the attitudes, you make it very real. You talked about your book being, your most recent book, Crossing Divides, being set in Syria, and you mentioned that you did research on the Internet. Now, did you say that you had or had not been there?
I have not been to Syria.
Okay. Well, that must have involved quite a bit of research then.
Oh, yes, it did involve a lot of research. Like I said, Internet research, speaking to people who had been to Syria. Yeah, my main character in this story is a reporter, so I actually have a friend who is an editor, who was a newspaper editor, so I spend a lot of time with her about how correspondents are managed and how they behave, that sort of thing. So I was actually very pleased when I sent the finished manuscript to the professor who had been with the United Nations. He sent it back and told me that I'd gotten everything exactly right except for one minor detail.
Oh, well, that's good.
He says you got it right. You described it right. You described the feeling of the place right. He said you did a very good job. So. It takes research, and it takes someone that knows people that can read your work to make sure that you got the detail correct.
Ah, yes. Well, I'm sure that nobody who would be reading the book, unless they've been immersed in the Syrian culture, would pick up on that one detail that you got wrong.
Well, I was able to fix the detail because it wasn't.
Oh, you were.
Come out. Oh, yes. This was pre-production, so I was actually able to fix the detail and make it right.
Cool. Well, what sort of journey is involved in Crossing Divides?
Well, basically, I've got two characters. I've got Crossing Divides involves a newspaper reporter who basically embeds himself with a band of freedom fighters that are fighting the Syrian government. And he basically falls in love with one of the freedom fighters.
Mm.
But you know, you've got to be careful given the culture and the feeling. And eventually he sort of figures out that the guy that he likes him back.
Ah.
But you've got the cultural differences. You've got geographic differences. He's a reporter. He's embedded. He's got to get out and go home. It's not as though Nemat can go home with him. So you've got separation. He comes back to Syria, and everything has changed. You know, the war has taken its toll. It's a grittier story than most romances. It's also incredibly powerful. And this particular story really made me work for that happy ending.
Mm. Well, without giving away the ending or too many of the conflicts, what is the power within the story and what makes it gritty?
Well, I describe war. They are in battle. It is in a war zone. Parts of it takes place in a war zone. Parts of it takes place after the results of war and the destruction of war. Basically,
well, you start the book right out with the war.
Yes.
The little bit of it that I read were right in the trenches, from the get-go.
That's correct. It starts right in the trenches, in battle. They rotate out, they go home, but the reporter needs proof of, is looking for proof of war crimes and atrocities that he can report on, and they find them, which, of course, once he gets back and writes the story, it paints a target on his back. So there's actually a lot going on in the story. It is very powerful. It hasn't been a huge commercial success, but it has been a very much a critical success. The reviewers and the people that have read it have absolutely loved it. It just seems to be a little grittier than most romances, so it hasn't yet hit that stride the way sometimes they do.
How did the writing of the story affect you?
It was deeply eye-opening.
How so?
Because when you're writing war, you're there. You may not have ever been in war, but your mind is taking you there.
That's okay. It happens to me. Well, let me ask you this. Is there a message in Crossing Divides that you'd like your readers to get?
Well, the number one thing about Crossing Divides, and it runs through a lot of my books, is that we build our own family, and that the world may put obstacles in our way, but it's very much a love conquers all type story. They come from two different worlds and two different ends of the world with two different cultures, but they're through work, determination, some luck, and sheer grit, they're able to make a happy ending for themselves.
Sounds like a lot of grace in there, too.
Oh, yeah, there's definitely grace.
How long did it take you to write the book?
Actually, it was an incredibly short period of time. I think it took me about 15 days.
My God, but what about the research? How long did that take?
That took about a month, but I was working on another book while I was doing the research.
Boy, you sure know how to do a juggling act.
Yeah, well, I'm generally as I'm working on a book, the other ideas are starting to churn in the back of my mind, so that when I finish one, I move right on to the next. I finished a manuscript on Tuesday, and then I finished one on Tuesday and started one yesterday.
Well, I do that with my books. I'm writing a series of books right now, and I'll get to the end of the book and I'll resolve it, but I'll have other ideas and I just plow right into the next book, and so I can relate to that. You know, let's talk a little bit about this concept that you mentioned of creating family, and I bring this up because with both of us being gay men and the experience for a lot of gay people is that they become disenfranchised from their own families and need to create a sense of family for themselves. Can you talk a little bit about how important that is for people, for gay people, in your experience?
In my experience, I think it's very important. Particularly from our generation, when as in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, we were more likely to be disenfranchised from our families. A lot of people in the country have changed, and hopefully that's becoming less of an issue. But with disenfranchised people, you have to build your own family. You have to build your own sense of community. It has to come from you.
Mm-hmm.
Society doesn't necessarily, or hasn't up till now, recognized our families. We are different. We don't have a mother and a woman and a man. We have two men, or we have two women. And so we have to fight for recognition. We have to build our own family. We have to build our own support group. And the interesting thing is that that family may not be two men and a kid or just two men. It may be two men and their entire circle of friends, because everybody sort of acts as each other's family.
Right. And that's so important in terms of preserving a sense of identity and raising one's self-esteem when there are so many negative messages that can come through from society or from homophobic people. And then there's even that internalized homophobia, old tapes that run through my head that I have to monitor to be careful that I don't take on that stuff and allow myself to go back into the closet, in a sense. I really liked what you were saying about the importance of family and how it can look so different for gay people. And I'm wondering, the other thing for me is I remember back in the day, back in the 70s, there were so many people that lived in gay ghettos and basically shut out the quote-unquote straight world. And I think, from my perspective, that's very limiting. And it for me to imagine myself in that situation, I would be missing out on the diversity of experience that's out there. I mean, life can be so delicious. And what I need to do is just recognize that not everybody's going to share my values or my opinions, but that there's so much richness out there that I can garner.
Well, one of the things that in my experience is that the gay ghettos are what we used to call them, like the Castro in San Francisco, or the gayborhood in Philadelphia. Those places, they have their place today. They still do. They're not as important as they used to be. And
right.
Acceptance has bloomed throughout the country. The ghetto was before, the ghetto was always a place of safety. It was safety
mm-hmm.
in numbers. People, if you were
mm-hmm.
around like people, then you were safer. Well, it isn't
right.
as necessary any longer. Those places are still there. They still do exist. They're still fun. They have clubs. They have restaurants and bookstores and all of that sort of stuff. But they aren't as necessary as they used to be.
Isn't that wonderful? We've come a long way.
It is wonderful. I live in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and on my block, I have these wonderful people. There's another gay couple that lives half a block away from us. It's just, it's wonderful. We didn't have, Dominic and I, my partner, and I did not have to live in a gay ghetto to feel safe. We live here. And I actually hate the term gay ghetto. I like gayborhood better.
I do, too. Well, how much of yourself do you put into your books, Andrew?
A great deal. There's some of me in every single book and every single character that I write. I mean, as a writer, it's hard for you not to put yourself in the people that you write and in the situations that you write. I have written characters that are the exact opposite of me, but I found that when push comes to shove and things get difficult and I'm really, really deep into it, writing away, they somehow meld into something that gets closer to me every single time. It just works.
Isn't that amazing how that works?
I have to remember that you can't separate yourself.
No, and we all have our dark sides, and it's so easy to think that somebody is the opposite of us, and when indeed they might be just displaying some aspects of our dark side that we haven't gotten in touch with.
Exactly.
Now, is Crossing Divides part of the series? I know you've mentioned that you've done several series.
No, Crossing Divides is standalone. It's on its own. There are some characters that appear from one of my other books. That one's called In Search of a Story. It's sort of an Easter egg type thing. When I write a book, if if the situation or a setting that intersects with another book, say that if I had some characters from one book that were to go to Wyoming, they might meet or see some of the characters from one of my other series. Sort of an Easter egg type thing. You put it in there so if people have read the other books, oh, that's them. And if they haven't, they wouldn't even notice.
Hmm. Well, I haven't read the book, as I mentioned, but I'm wondering if readers get to the end of the book, if they'll be thirsting for more, and if you'd consider doing a sequel to the book.
I have considered it. I just sort of have to wait to see what comes, see what ideas bubble up.
Mm-hmm. What are you working on now?
Right now I am working on the third novella, which is a shorter work, in a series that's set in Kansas. The first book in this series is called Dumped in Oz, and it comes out Wednesday, as a matter of fact. It's going to be released
Wednesday.
Oh, that's
wonderful.
Dumped in Oz is basically about a guy who gets transferred to his company's warehouse in central Kansas. And he stumbles into a little town called Wamego, Kansas, and Wamego, Kansas is real.
I wondered.
Wamego, Kansas is the home of the Oz Winery, the Oz Museum, Toto's Tacos, and their own Yellow Brick Road. Yes, hence the Oz reference.
Well, I live in upstate New York, and there's a little town near here where Frank Baum, the creator of The Wizard of Oz, lived, called Chittenango, and every mm-hmm. year they do an Oz festival up here, which is a big to-do. In fact, up until recent years, they've had surviving members of the movie, like Munchkins, present for mm-hmm. the carnival. So I'm interested in the book. And just to let the readers know, if you look on Blog Talk Radio, I believe there is a cover of this latest book that's coming out on the advertisement for today's show.
Yeah, it was fun. I was out there. I was in Kansas on a business trip, and we went into Wamego for the day because we'd seen signs for the winery and the museum, and we had to check this out. So on a Sunday afternoon, we wandered through the town, and it was like traveling back in time. It's got all the Oz things, but it's incredibly clean. It's got this beautiful downtown that looks like something out of the 50s, and it's well maintained. It's
nice.
It's just like stumbling back in time. It was a really cute town. And when I was in Kansas, I met wonderful people. So I decided to take Dumped in Oz and turn it into a love letter to one of the states that people generally fly over.
How nice.
So,
can you tell us a little bit more about the series?
The first one, as I said, is Dumped in Oz. The second one is Stuck in Oz, and it takes place in winter. And basically my main character is driving through with his brother. Their parents have died, and he's taking custody of his young brother, and he's trying to visit his uncle who lives in Wamego to see if he can get some help. So he gets sort of stuck in Oz in the middle of winter, and the town sort of has a way of working on you. At least in my fictional version of the town. I did not go back into my small town roots for this town. I wanted this town to represent the wonderful people that I met in Kansas. So the townspeople, in one of the books, one of the characters is an alcoholic, and he's having a tough time of it, so he goes in the bar, asks for a drink, and they refuse to serve him. They don't serve him because they know that the next day he will regret his decision. They sort of form ranks around him. They stand up for him. They protect him. They look out for him. So that I wanted the town to represent what a small town should, which is people supporting and looking after each other, sort of like an extended family. I didn't go with the usual small town attitude. I went different. I really wanted to sort of, like I said, turn this into a love letter for a state that when I went there on a business trip, I didn't expect to like and turned out loving.
Oh, isn't that nice? I'm sure the people of Kansas appreciate that. Tell me a little bit more about some of your other series.
Well, I have a farm series. It's the Love Means series. The first book is Love Means No Shame. The next one is Love Means Courage. And there are right now seven
books. Oh, I
love those
titles.
Well, I've got Love Means No Shame, Love Means Courage, Love Means No Boundaries, Love Means Freedom, No Limits, Love Means Family, and Love Means No Fear. And the last one that I've just recently written is Love Means Patience.
Wow.
And basically, these all take place in and around a small town where I grew up on a farm where, as I was growing up, I worked cleaning stalls. So I set the whole thing on this particular farm. Love Means No Shame has an Amish character, so it's an Amish and a non-Amish character.
Do you trace some of the same characters through the series?
Yes. Yes, Jeff and Eli, who from Love Means No Shame, appear in all of the books with the exception of Love Means Courage. Love Means Courage, I wrote Love Means No Shame first, and then fell in love with Jeff, my main character's gay parents. He had two fathers. So I went back into history and wrote the father's story.
Oh, neat.
So
I trust that Jeff is a gay character too?
Yes. Yes. In Love Means No Shame, Jeff and his partner meets his partner, who's Eli, who is Amish. And then, like I said, he had gay parents, so we went back. And Love Means Courage was absolutely a lot of fun because I got to write Jeff as a 2-year-old.
Oh.
So Jeff is the one character that goes all through all of those novels, and he's the character I know the best. Because I've written Jeff from 2 years old to up now to his mid-30s.
Ah. Does the Amish character travel through him within the series, or do you not want to get into that?
Well, Eli is Jeff's partner. So in the first book, he's very tentative. He's figuring his way outside of the Amish community. And as the books go on, he becomes more and more of a force. He grows and becomes more confident and more self-assured and eventually a father.
Hmm.
Because in love with the family, they adopt.
Oh, nice. Nice. I love the titles. I especially love Means No Shame, because to me, having lived as a gay man in a state of shame for so many years and coming to see, first of all, that I wasn't even in touch with my shame, and then to see how toxic it was, I just love that title. And likewise, I love the title of Love Means No Fear. I've heard it said that there are just two conditions. One of my favorite spiritual authors, Anthony DeMello, speaks of the condition of love or fear. And love is of the spirit and fear is of the ego, which is the false self, as some people might say. And for me to lead a happy and healthy life, I need to stay in that place of spirit and to remember love. So can you tell me a little bit about Love Means No Fear?
Well, Love Means No Fear. Basically, in Love Means No Shame, we meet Eli, who is leaving the Amish community. Basically, Jeff comes out one day, and you know the whole Love Means No Shame was all predicated on one basic sentence: what is a little Amish boy doing sleeping in my barn? Okay, that's how they meet. And then the story goes on from there. In Love Means No Fear, we have Eli as well as his brother, Jonah, must deal with their father and their parents. because Jonah basically goes, spends his year away, and he looks up Eli because he realizes that he is gay as well. And
I just caught on to that. I was looking at my I have a script here, and I just caught on to that. That's clever.
So basically he, you know, he catches on to him, and you know, Jonah comes to visit Eli, and basically Jonah has to come to grips with who he is. And some of the pairings are very interesting, because I paired Jonah, an Amish kid, with Rain, a Chicago full-on party boy.
Oh, boy. That sounds like an interesting contrast.
He has to. So, you know, Jonah has to figure out who he is, and Rain needs to come to grips with the fact that he's falling in love with someone completely different than what he ever expected.
Oh, well, that sure happens in real life. Happened to me.
It most certainly does. It most certainly does. It does happen. Absolutely happens in real life. Did for me, too.
Tell me about your partner. How long have you guys been together, and do you consider yourselves similar, or was it a case of opposites attract?
Dominic and I are, he and I had a great romance. In order for a romance to work, you got to have two things. You know, there has to be some differences, because those add spice to life, and there have to be some things that are similar. Dominic and I are similar in that we're both, you know, academic people. We both love to read. We both love to talk and travel and that sort of thing. But Dominic has worked for a number of years as a pastry chef. So he's very much in tune with food. He's very much a foodie. For me, food is a matter of, okay, I have to eat this. Okay, we eat. Now I can go on and do other things. And for him, dinner can take an hour. For me, 15 minutes is just fine. I got other things to do.
Yeah, right. You got another book to write.
Yeah. You know, I'm 6'2". Dominic is 5'4".
Ah.
In some ways, we are opposites in some ways. We complement each other very much in some ways, and in other ones, we're very much the same. And
when did you meet him?
We've been together 20 years.
Oh, that's wonderful.
We've been together
I love
20
to hear
years.
Stories like that.
And I wouldn't, you know, I get asked questions about if you could live anywhere, where would you live? You know, if you could live anywhere in the world, where would you live? If you could do, and the answer is it doesn't really matter. As long as I was with Dominic, that's home. He's home.
Hmm.
I mean, he and I spent a number of years, we lived in Wisconsin. We ended up moving to Pennsylvania because my job moved me. And we moved together because if he wouldn't have wanted to move, I would have turned it down.
Hmm.
He's home.
It's lovely.
Geography is less material than the fact that he's there.
Mm-hmm. I can appreciate that, and I have felt that way about partners that I've been with in the past, too. Let's get back to your writing. Can you tell me what a typical writing day is like?
I recently quit the evil day job, so I am working on writing full time. I write full time now.
Good for you.
Dominic gets up at 6 o'clock, and I get up before he leaves the house. Then I basically get dressed in what everybody would love to be able to work in, sweatpants and a t-shirt, and then I go into my office. I do email till 8 o'clock, then I turn everything off. The email, the phone, put the phone on vibrate, stick it someplace else, turn off all the applications, the internet, so on and so forth, and I write from 8 to 11.
Oh, wow.
From at about 11 o'clock, I will take a break. I will get something to eat, do any running that I have to do, come back to the house, check email again, do Facebook or internet stuff till 1 o'clock. And then from about 1 to 4, generally, I will sit down and write again.
Mm.
At 4 o'clock, I then have to put it aside. Since I quit my day job, I'm working for my publisher coordinating the production of audiobooks. So I do some of the audiobook work. I'll do some promotional work, interviews, answer questions, all that sort of stuff, through Facebook, that sort of thing in the evening. And then at about 8 o'clock at night, everything gets turned off and it's quiet.
Well, it sure sounds like you put your all into it and that you found your passion. And I'm so happy for you that you've been able to quit your day job and pursue your passion. That must be such a wonderful, wonderful thing for you.
It was. I absolutely love it. I absolutely love what I'm doing. The job that I was doing 40 hours a week was becoming more and more of a distraction. It was taking a lot of energy, a lot of time, and towards the end it got to the point where it was killing the muse.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to stop. I had to decide what was important. Dominic and I sat down. We talked about, you know, budgets and money and possibilities and how we can do various things. And we realized that, yes, no, I can quit the day job and I can be happy.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, you mentioned that it only took 15 days to write Crossing Divides. What's a typical amount of time that you put into writing a book?
It depends upon length. I write at a rate of about 5,000 words per day. So what I want is I want to write at a rate of about 30,000 words a week. I take
what does
one
that
day
translate to in terms of... What does that translate to
novel,
in terms of pages?
A novel, well, 60,000 words is the minimum for a novel, and that's about 200 pages. The novel I just finished was about 75,000 words. That's going to be about 240 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote that one in about 18 or so writing days.
Okay, so 5,000... words would
longer.
Be. I was just trying to break it down into. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say 5,000 words a day comes up to be, for 75,000 words, comes up to be about 15 writing days. The holidays and Christmas and New Year's and everything else were also in there. So that, you know, I took extra time off because of the holidays.
Mm hmm. Now, you have written over 50 books. How many more do you think you have in you?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. 100? 200? I don't intend to stop.
Well, that's great. That's great. That's wonderful. Well, keep writing. My God.
I've also, one of the things I really love, my publisher, who is Dream Spinner Press, has a young adult imprint called Harmony, Inc. So what I have done is I have, under a different pen name, under the pen name of Jeff Lawton, and you're going to love this, Jeff Lawton happens to be the name of the character in Love Means No Shame. So I wrote a young adult.
That's wonderful. How do you spell the pen name?
It's G-E-O-F-F, and then Lawton is L-A-U-G-H-T-O-N.
Okay. All right. And so if somebody wants to find that book, where would they go?
You
and
can
what's
get it
the title
Amazon.
Of the book?
The title of the book is By the Creek. This book touched me deeply. I use a lot of my own young adult experiences and fears, sort of exercise them. Basically, what I've got in this story is I've got David, who relocates from a larger town to a smaller town, and he meets Benjamin, and Benjamin is Amish. and lives across the street in the Amish community. You know, their worlds would never meet otherwise, except for the neutral ground, which is the swimming hole down by the creek.
Cute.
So by the creek
is
the neutral ground. It's where it's where he can go swim if he wants. It's where the Amish kids are allowed to swim. It's the neutral ground. It's the only place where their lives could possibly intersect. And basically, these two kids fall in love. And it was very difficult to come up with a happy ending for this one. I did it. We have a happy ending.
They all have happy endings, son?
Yes. There's enough. The world is harsh enough. The world is cruel enough and difficult enough that when I read books and write books, they have to have a happy ending.
I like that.
I mean, I came of age, and I'm sure you did too, or at least part of it, in the AIDS era, when every book that was written with gay characters was depressing beyond belief.
Yes.
There was no happy ending. A happy ending wasn't possible. You know, everybody died or whatever. Well, I don't want that. I stopped reading gay fiction years ago because of that. And I didn't want that, want to read and be depressed.
Right.
So,
well, I think that's wonderful.
Enough, we're mean enough, so.
I think we all need things to uplift our spirits. As you say, the world is not always the friendliest of places. And one of the things that I explore on this show are things that can raise our spirits. And I know that we've talked a little bit, and you've told me you're not a particularly spiritual person. I wondered if you could tell me what that's about, if you ever had felt oppressed or abused by religion.
Not so much oppressed or abused. For me, it just isn't a part of my daily life. Religion itself isn't part of my daily life. When Dominic and I lived in Milwaukee, I was a member of a church in Milwaukee. We had a great church choir, which I sang in the church choir, and we were supported. Out here, I looked into a few churches. They were very conservative. I did not feel I didn't feel accepting, and I wasn't going to fight. I wasn't going to fight those attitudes. I fought them long enough. I didn't want to do it anymore. I didn't want to have that in my life. So it was just one of those things that sort of got left behind.
Well, I don't find that religion is that important in my life either, but I consider myself a deeply spiritual person. It just so happens that I found a church that embraces my own belief systems, which is like a miracle to me. But, you know, I've looked at my life as being a journey of the spirit, and by that I very simply mean that it's been a matter of following my dreams, being sustained by hope, having faith that I'm here for a reason and that I'm moving forward to some better good for myself and hopefully for others. So I'm wondering if you can somehow see where your life has been a spiritual journey.
Oh, it's in that respect, it's definitely been a spiritual journey. I write hope. Romance novels are hope. That's what we're writing. We are writing that no matter what, these two that are two people, no matter what gets thrown in their way, can somehow find love. What's more hopeful and more spiritual than that? So that's what I write. From that perspective, you're absolutely right, because that's what I write. That's what I live every day.
Well, we've talked a little bit about your life's journey. I'm just wondering what sort of journey you have taken to come to terms with who you are today.
Oh, wow. It's been a long journey. It's been a long journey, but thankfully I haven't had to make it alone. The beautiful thing was that shortly after I came out and figured out who I was, which was about 1990. I moved from California to Wisconsin. I met some wonderful people in Wisconsin who introduced me to Dominic, and my life changed. I was suddenly not alone. You know, I have a partner now of 20 years. I've had someone that has stood by me for 20 years, and I've stood by him. I wasn't going through life alone. I'm not going through life alone. I have someone that's always in my corner.
That's wonderful. Wouldn't it be nice if that could be the case for everybody? What would you say to people that do not have that in their lives? What kinds of things can you offer to people that would inspire them to find hope for themselves without having another person in their life? Can you imagine what that might be?
Well, love comes in love and support come in many, many different forms. I mean, I'm lucky in that I have a loving and supportive partner. But I also have great friends who are incredibly supportive and caring. There was a book I read a number of years ago that Armistead was one of the lines from Armistead Maupin's Tales of the City books. I don't need a lover; I just need five good friends.
I love those books. Armistead, if you're listening, I want you on my show. Pardon me?
Yes, I absolutely.
You heard me say that,
books.
Didn't you?
Yes, I did.
I've absolutely read those books.
And he's got some real.
I've read the series.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. I just have to say I have reread that series. The entire series, which there are six books, I believe, and now he's come out with some new ones, but originally there were six books, and every 5 years I sit down and I read through all of them.
Well, the latest two are really good because
yeah.
the one takes Michael in sort of it's an extended epilogue to Michael, and then the last one is an extended epilogue to Marianne.
Yes. Yes, I read the one on Michael. I haven't read the one on Marianne.
I like the one on Marianne even better. I
really?
Just like the one
well,
on
I'll
Marianne.
I'll have to get
yeah.
that.
Yeah, because yeah. he really pulls in even stuff from the first book. He ties up a lot of things, and you see a lot of what Marianne has done and the way she's grown and come back to where she was.
Mm-hmm.
You get the ending of her spiritual journey. In those six books, we have one character beginning, we have one Marianne at the beginning, and a very different Marianne at the end, where you finally get the end of her journey.
Well, you know, I'm glad that you were able to acknowledge a spiritual journey along another set of lines, because I think so many people don't realize that they're on that, perhaps even people that consider themselves atheists. May not embrace things like hope and faith that they're moving towards something better in their lives as being a spiritual journey, and I have to respect that opinion.
Hope, love, goodness, helping others are universal. They really don't touch on religion. They're not the domain of any religion. They're universal. They're part of the human condition.
And I think that's important to recognize that spirituality doesn't have anything to do with religion per se. Religion can enhance spirituality, but that's not what it's about. We're coming to a close here, and I'd like to invite you to come back. Will you come back this summer?
I would love to.
Because I'd like to talk about some more of your books and see what your latest project is. Would you just tell our listeners where they can find your books?
Well, you can find my books actually through my website, www.andrewgreybooks.com. You can also find all of them at Dream Spinner Press. That's www.dreamspinner.com, and they have them all. They have a store where they can all be purchased, and they do run sales and things. Amazon is also all my books are available in both print and ebook form on Amazon, as well as BarnesandNoble.com, and you can get them from TLA, TLA.
Well, thank you, Andrew. I really appreciate you being with me today. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, but I'm glad that you're going to come back and join us again this summer. And so I thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It was wonderful.
You're welcome. So once again, we come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our own individual gifts. And we thank Andrew for sharing his gifts today and invite you all to go out and buy his books. And I'm sure that many of them are available in ebook form too. Let's keep in
Absolutely.
Mind there's no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We're each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who are having a spiritual experience. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.
You have been listening to Different Strokes for Different Folks. To find common ground and take it to the next level, here on Blog Talk Radio with David Clark, every Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. You can listen to this broadcast again on srbroadcasting.com.
Thank you.